a week ago on Sunday, about this same time, at a church in Texas called, in the city of Sutherland Springs, they were having their Sunday morning service also. A man walked into the back of the church during the service with automatic rifles, guns, and started methodically shooting people. They know this because they broadcast their service. They play it back on YouTube. And so there's actually a film, a video of what he was doing. So basically he was going up and down the aisles and shooting every single person that he could. Didn't matter if they were a man, a woman, a child. Didn't matter how young they were or how old they were. He basically wanted to kill everyone. It's been said that it's the largest mass shooting in any house of worship in the United States ever. So 2 dozen people were killed. 20 plus people were injured severely. And although the gunman's motives seem to be related to a domestic issue, a domestic problem, it sort of makes us wonder, you know, is there any place that's sort of safe for Christians? I mean, we come to church on Sunday morning, and we just have this hope, this expectation that, hey, we're going to have a great time here. We're going to sing songs, hear some words about Jesus, and be safe. Is there any place that's safe for Christians? Because the church itself should be the sanctuary, right? The sacred place, a place that's insulated, that's away from all the wrongs of the world. Yet it's not. So as Christians, you know, we obviously don't live in the church building all of our lives. That doesn't happen. And so, you know, we go out every single day and we sort of just live our lives out in the world. Christian missionaries, by and large, go to places all over this globe and sometimes go into knowingly dangerous places, that their physical lives are in danger, all for the sake of sharing the gospel message to people who may not have ever heard it before. And that takes, I think, a special kind of person to know that, hey, they're going to go into a place where they could possibly get killed. There's just dangers left and right. But their passion and their desire is to bring Jesus to people who don't know Jesus. So we're in the short series called The Blood of the Saints. Last week I talked about the Ecuador Five, made famous by a man named Jim Elliot. And they went to Ecuador to share the gospel to this tribe that didn't have very much interaction with the Western world. And they were on the beach for 4 or 6 days before these tribesmen killed them with spears. And by their deaths and the continuing work of their families, their work was propelled into many, many other future missionaries. Next week, we're going to talk about a couple named John and Betty Stamm, who are in Asia. Today, we're talking about a woman named Helen Rosevere. She did not die on the missions field. She's not a martyr. But her story, which came to light because she just died last year, her story was one that will make you question, why do you ever ask God why? So let's talk about Helen a little bit. This is Helen Rosevere. She was born in 1925 in a city called Haileybury, England. She attended Catholic Church as a young girl. She heard stories of missionaries, and she felt very strongly as a young person to go into missions. And she felt so strongly that she couldn't understand any Christian who didn't have that passion upon their own heart. Like, if you're a Christian, you should be preparing for missions, because that's what we're supposed to do. Academics was a very high priority in her family, and at the age of 12, she was sent to a very prestigious all-girls school. And she carried this burden, because academics was such a high priority, she carried this burden of not being good enough, not having good enough grades. And she's worried about not doing well. She worried about losing her parents' respect or their love because of her grades. She has perfectionistic mentality. Sort of sounds like she'd be Asian, right? And although she didn't understand the full meaning of what it meant, she actually got confirmed as a young girl. So when young people go through confirmation, they go through classes to understand more about what it means to be a Christian, and then they make a public commitment to follow Jesus. So she was confirmed in the church. In 1944, she went to college and studied medicine at Newnham College at Cambridge University, fairly prestigious. She was sort of awkward, shy, lonely type girl. So older women there actually befriended her and invited her to what was called the Cambridge Intercollegiate Christian Union, where they had Bible studies, Christian talks, activities, events. So you can equate it to InterVarsity on campus, or Campus Crew is what they're called now. And so these campus Christian groups go out and they help Christians and reach out to non-Christians also. Her friends thought she was a Christian, but in her heart, she really didn't feel that way. And this is what she said. She said, "As yet, I had no peace, no heart satisfaction. I was sure it," meaning Christianity, "I was sure it was real and the truth, but I was also conscious that I lacked something." She was a Christian in name, but not in heart. And she actually knew this. She realized this. Before this moment, she was not truly a follower of Jesus. And she did all the right things that good Christians are supposed to do. She went to church. She went to Bible study. She went through all these activities. But Jesus wasn't a reality in her heart. So over the months, as she got more and more involved with this campus group, and she read her Bible, she went to Bible studies, asked questions, she eventually experienced God's grace and forgiveness and the love and the friendship of Jesus, and she became a sincere follower of Jesus. The Bible study leader gave her a new Bible, and inside the front cover of that Bible was this text, Philippians 3:10. Which reads, "That I may know him, Jesus, and the power of his resurrection, and may share his sufferings, becoming like him in his death." So that was inscribed in the front of her Bible. And the full context, that passage reads this way. This is the Apostle Paul writing, "Whatever gain I had, I counted as loss for the sake of Christ. Indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Jesus, my Lord. For his sake, I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish, in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes through faith in Christ, the righteousness from God that depends on faith." In verse 10, "that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and may share in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that by any means possible I may attain the resurrection from the dead." And she just came to this realization that all she had, whether it was her stuff, her friendships, her family, her education, her degrees, were all rubbish compared to the worth and the beauty and the majesty of knowing who Jesus Christ is. And she said, "Everything is just rubbish, and I'm willing to suffer because Jesus Christ suffered for me." Sometimes we think of missionaries as these super Christians, these perfect people. But they are not, and they go through doubts and struggles and trials, and Helen Roosevelt was no different. So in her time of studies in medicine and her time trying to learn more about Christianity, she had this sense of nagging insecurity and doubt in her life. She was exhausted with her studies, with her side work. She was exhausted with just living life. She was unhappy. She was lonely. She was fearful. And in her mind, all she saw was the highs and the lows of Christian maturity. One day she'd be high, one day she'd be low. Next day she'd be high, next day she'd be low, next day she'd be lower. She just saw herself on this vertical plane. And she realized her thinking about Christian growth and maturity was wrong, because she was thinking simply in terms of this vertical axis of highs and lows. She said this, The going down was merely an initial moving towards the next higher ground, never going back to base level, so to speak. The shadow was only relative after the brightness of the sun. The valley could provide a period of rest for refreshment, preparatory for the next hard climb. Had I understood this meaning of the sunshine and the shadow in my life, rather than interpreting my various experiences along life's ways as up or down, I might have saved myself many deep heartaches. And sometimes we think this way too. And the best way I can do is just show you this. Sometimes we think we're on the left side, right? That all we think about Christian life and our growth in general is we're up or we're down. We're up or we're down. What Helen Roosevelt is saying is more like this line on the right side. That sometimes you're feeling at a peak, a high, a mountaintop, and then other times in life you go down into this valley. But you never stay there. You go up again, and as you go up, you see the sunshine, even though the next period of your life may be the shadows of the valley. And it's a continuum of time as you go left to right. That as you live life more, you experience Jesus more in a different and more fruitful way. At the end of a medical school, she could easily have made this career as a doctor and made a lot of money in England. But she joined a missions organization called the Worldwide Evangelization Crusade, WEC. I think today it's called the Worldwide Evangelization for Christ, because no one wants to be associated with the Crusades. That's the idea. She wanted to go to Africa, so she spent 8 months learning French and studying tropical diseases. In 1953, at the ripe old age of 27, she sailed from London to the Belgian Congo. So the Belgian Congo is this red dot right here, that country. England is above France at the very top of the map. So she had to sail around France through the Straits of Gibraltar, across the Mediterranean Sea, down through the Suez Canal, all the way down to through the eastern seaboard of Africa, to get to the Belgian Congo. So remember, this is 1953. We're not talking about major airliners going into these different cities. This is how she got there, and it took her 6 weeks to get there from England. The Belgian Congo was colonized in 1908 by Belgium at the initiation of their king, the Belgian king, King Leopold II. So basically, a lot of European countries said, hey, Africa's ripe for the taking. Let's divide it up. Let's colonize it. Okay, that's what they did. So the Belgian rule in Congo was based upon this colonial trinity. They tried to justify their reason for being there. And they said, well, there's three reasons. State, which is good for the country, both countries. There's a missions emphasis. Second, and thirdly, there's private company interest. So it makes money for different private companies. The Belgian Congo, as it was called, was ruled with a heavy hand, with military might, not by the cooperation of local leaders and people. A large number of whites moved there to the Belgian Congo after the end of World War II, and the whites were always treated as superior to black people there. The main resources out of there were copper, rubber, palm oil, and it's basically free labor also. So Belgians forced the local people to grow cash crops. Cash crops are those crops that you make a lot of cash from quickly. So cotton, coffee, nuts, sort of thing. The justification for colonialism in Africa often invoked this idea of having the civilizing influence of Europe over this primitive culture. So they wanted to convert people to religious truth. They wanted to bring basic Western lifestyle education to the people and improve their health care. That is what they said. But the bottom line is basically it made Belgium a lot of money. That's why countries were colonized. In 1953, Helen Roosevelt started with nothing in a village called Ibambi. Ibambi is, this is the Congo. That blue arrow in the top right quadrant the Congo, and that's where she was, in the middle of the jungle. And she started with a table, a stool, and a stove. She had local patients there, mostly malaria patients. And she would see maybe 200 patients per day, just doing the best she could to run them through and get medicine. But she discovered that as she treated patients, they were more and more open to hearing the message about the gospel, which sort of reinforces the idea that we know as Christians now is, you know, the more that you act and the more that you're like Jesus, the more people want to hear and are open to hearing about Jesus. She began training local medical workers who were, you know, ages 18 to 24. Their highest education was middle school, right? It's a picture of her. And so she had all this work. She was treating patients. She was training new medical workers, and she didn't have very much. With all her attention to patients and students, she became irritable. She had a short temper, and she became angry all the time. She had outbursts. And she blamed it on her lack of sleep and inadequate rest. Sometimes we do that too, right? Which I didn't get enough sleep, so it justifies why I'm angry all the time. A Congolese Christian came up to her after one outburst and said, you know, don't excuse yourself. Call sin, sin, and temper, temper. Then face up to the fact that your white skin makes you no different than the rest of us. If you can only show us Dr. Helen, you might as well go home. The people need to see Jesus. And, you know, if she just went there to be a doctor, then, yeah, that's her job. But the people knew her as a Christian doctor. And so the local people knew that with her influence as a doctor, she could reach more people for the sake of Jesus. In 1955, she was assigned to a village called Nebodanga, which is about 7 miles from Ibambi, where she was. She built a maternity ward. She built a training center for students. She built a 100-bed hospital there, and she helped. She used her own hands. She didn't just direct people and say, oh, you need to make bricks here and build this wall here and put beds in here. She actually helped. And so one particular day, when her hands were cut and sore from making bricks, she, you know, form them out of clay and mud and bring them to the kiln and move them to different places, she was complaining. Her hands hurt. And again, another Congolese Christian went up to her and said, you know, Dr. Helen, when you're down at the kiln where they fired the bricks, when you're down at the kiln with us and your hands are rough as ours are, and when you're out at the markets using our language, that's when we love you and how we come to know and trust you, and we can listen to you when you tell us of God and his ways. He told her that while she was attending to the patients, patient after patient after patient, there were other local Christians there that were sharing the gospel. And every week, 10 or 15 local people will come to know who Jesus Christ was. And she learned the importance of being Jesus wherever you are and whatever you're doing. And so she was right there in the midst of them. She didn't like say, I'm better than you. I'm going to direct you to do what you need to do for me. She got down on her hands and knees and she made bricks. So each year, 100 patients went through surgery. She wasn't a surgeon, but she figured out how to do this because she was the only medical person for hundreds of miles. 100 young men and women were trained to be medical helpers. All the patients heard the gospel through the ministry of local chaplains, hospital chaplains, and she established 48 rural health clinics in the immediate vicinity of the hospital. So people didn't have to come to the hospital. She created all these smaller health clinics. I could not find any pictures of that site where she was in the 1950s. These are modern day pictures. This is the today's lay of the center there. And so there's a men's ward, women's ward, operating room. There's an old operating room. This is not a modern building. This is not a modern site. Okay, this is in the jungle still. Okay. And so as you look at this, you know, I'll show you a couple more pictures. These are pictures from today, right? This is pictures from today, not 60 years ago. But if this is a picture from today, imagine what it was like 60 years ago, right? So it was probably even worse, worse conditions. This is sort of their, I don't know what to call it, like their operating area, right? And you know, where they put all their medicines and cleaned up everything. And so when you go deep into an area where you're away from modern technology, modern conveniences, it's hard, right? And it's hard today. And so there's a Christian organization that sort of oversees all that happens in this area. So it's very interesting that they go in and they help out with all this medical the needs that are there. In 1958, she actually went back to England on furlough. She was disillusioned with missionary work. She had been there for quite a few years. She questioned her time in the Belgian Congo. She had difficulty working with male counterparts, particularly those who were put in place to be her superiors. She always rubbed them the wrong way. So when she was back in England on her furlough, she struggled why do I have these issues with men? Why do I have these issues with men who are my superiors? She convinced herself that her problem was with her singleness. And what she needed was that she needed to marry someone, a man who could be her husband and a doctor, right? And that would serve with her side by side. She convinced herself of that. So she didn't think that was too much to ask of God. So she said, God, give me a husband who's a doctor who will serve, you know, by my side. And she made a deal with God, maybe more like an ultimatum. She said, God, I'm not going back as a missionary until I'm married to this type of person. How many of us have done that sort of thing? And it's not a bad prayer request, right? It's like, I want to marry someone who will help me in my ministry and my missions. But she wasn't really patient with God's timing. She was introduced to this fellow doctor, tall, dark, and handsome. And she decided he's the one. She decided he's the one. So she did everything she could to try to win his love over. She bought new clothes. She got a new hairdo. She officially resigned from the missions, or put God in a corner, right? But this doctor guy didn't care for her in that way. So I guess they had their DTR talk, you know, determining the relationship talk. And, you know, he said, well, I like you as a friend, or I love you, but I'm not in love with you. You know, whatever people say to each other nowadays, right? But he didn't, you know, he wasn't feeling it like, you know, she was feeling it. So Helen was heartbroken. She had wasted so much time and money trying to force her plan into reality, all without God's guidance or help. So in 1960, she returned to the Belgian Congo as a single woman. In 1960, Belgium granted independence to the Belgian Congo, and they officially renamed the country Congo. And they installed a local national government, and they had an army to keep control called the National Army. Many non-Africans in the Congo felt very unsettled because they didn't have the Belgian army to sort of watch over them and keep them safe. So many missionaries and dignitaries and statespeople, they actually left. They fled the Congo because the risk of violence was so high. Now, Helen had no plans of going back to England. She felt God had called her there, and he would protect her if she stayed. Eventually, she was the only European left in her village, in her center there. And there weren't that many Europeans anyway, but she was the only one left. Because of differing factions and corruption in the government, the local government, there were all these rebel uprisings. In 1964, rebel guerrilla forces started fighting against the National Army. This one particular group called the Simbas, yes, Simbas, meaning lions, tried to overthrow the government. And in her region, the Simbas drove out the National Army. They were notorious for using drugs and alcohol. They were always high all the time or just crazy on opiates. And they were heavy into witchcraft. There were stories of them taking a person and cutting them open while they were still alive and eating their organs because they believed that that would give them vitality and strength and power. They were brutal. They terrorized and terrified the locals. There was death and blood in the streets. Thousands and thousands of people died. After about 10 weeks, the National Army began to regain control. They started fighting back. The Simbas believed that a stronger witchcraft was helping the National Army. And they rationalized to themselves that, well, these white doctors must have this stronger witchcraft. And so they turned on any white doctor. In October 1964, the rebel soldiers came into her village area. They ransacked and destroyed her home. Helen Roosevelt was severely beaten. She was kicked ruthlessly, and she had her teeth knocked out. They just beat her. And she was brutally raped, repeatedly. Rape, unfortunately, sexual assault has become a weapon of war, if I could use that phrase. Back then, even before then, and up to today, if you read about any conflicts that we have anywhere across the globe, rape is probably a very central component to what the invading forces do. Today, in the eastern provinces of Congo, where Helen Roosevelt was, the United Nations has called that the rape capital of the world. The United Nations itself. I read a story in the last couple of days where about 20 military soldiers are on trial because they were involved in these mass rapes. And so they had raped men and women, male and females, from children to old people. Helen Roosevelt felt abandoned by God. Like, why did you leave me? Right? I thought you were going to protect me. And in her anguish and in her depths of despair, she remembered her Bible. And her Bible, inside that cover, that verse, Philippians 3:10, that I may know Jesus and the power of his resurrection and may share his sufferings, becoming like him in his death. Now, remembering that verse never made her ask the question, why does God allow missionaries to suffer? Because for her, when she took that verse to heart, she realized there's a privilege in suffering with and for Jesus. It was her privilege. And maybe the way she thought about it was that her body was on loan. You know, if you're a Christian, everything that we have is given by God, right? And we're supposed to steward it. We're supposed to take care of it. And so whether it's our money, our material things, our children, our spouses, our jobs, we're supposed to steward them and make the most out of them because God has given those sorts of things to us. But you know what else God gives us? He gives us our bodies. And we're supposed to steward and use our bodies in the best possible way. And so if you think about it that way, a verse like Romans 12, when Paul writes, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. And when we read this verse as Western Christians, we just think, oh yeah, present our bodies holy. And so we're thinking, okay, let's try not to sin as much as we usually do. Let's try to put our spouse on a path of righteousness. Let's try to be more like Jesus. So when we come to church on Sunday, we can sing with joy and truthfulness. We can pray with honesty. That's what we think about when we read this verse. But the verse says, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. That means your physical body also. Everything about who you are, present your bodies. So she never asked the question, is it worth it? Is what she was doing, is it worth it? And when we ask that question, And if she would have asked that question, there's always lingering doubts, right? Is it worth it? Yeah, maybe, I don't know, it could be. If the situation was different, yeah, it would be worth it. She never asked that question. But she asked a different question. Her question was, is he worthy? Is Jesus worthy? And that answer was absolutely all the time, 24/7. Over the next 10 weeks or so, Helen did all she could to protect the other women from being raped. They basically would line them up, and they would take them out one by one to be brutally assaulted. And she would try to get to the front of the line and protect them. And she would do everything she could, even if it meant putting herself at risk. Finally, about 10 or 12 weeks later, the National Army came in. She was rescued and returned to England. This is an article, Doctor Among Congo Rebels. And so she recuperated, she went back, and after about a year, she said, I'm going to go back to the Congo. It wasn't called Congo anymore, it was called Zaire. So this is where I got confused, like, yeah, there was a country named Zaire, right? So it was called the Belgian Congo, then the Congo, now it's named Zaire. So she returned to the region to train and establish a medical center. In 1973, she finally said, I'm going to go back to England. She had stayed for an additional 7 years. After all that happened, she stayed for 7 years. And over the following years, after she officially left, she actually went back a few times to visit the Congo. I'm sorry, Zaire, which is now called the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's its current name, right? This is all in a matter of like 60 or 70 years, right? But just before she left for England, that very last time, she met a man on the roadside, and he went up to her and he said, are you a sent one? Now she's a missionary, right? She knows missionaries are sent. So she said, what do you mean by that? And he said, are you a sent one by a great God to tell me about something called Jesus? Yeah, okay. He walked right into that one, right? And so she had her Bible with her, and she said, can you read? He said, no, I can't read. She said, oh. So she had been carrying around something called a wordless book. So some of you have seen these or have actually even used these. So each color represents some aspect of the Christian faith, right? And so the green says, oh, God created everything, and everything was perfect, but black, sin entered the world, and we live this horrible life now because of evil and the chaos in this world, but Jesus died upon the cross, and they shed his blood, the red, and then the white says, because we believe in him, our lives are made pure again, and we're forgiven, and the gold represents life eternal in heaven. And so this is a very easy way to share the gospel with people who are like visual people who may have more difficult time understanding and processing words. This is something similar that we've used before. This is sort of neat because you can flip it back and forth. Same sort of thing, same colors. You can flip it this way and show different symbols here. And we used it when we went to the Dominican Republic, and I know some other groups have used these also. And so she's carrying this wordless book around. And the guy says, I can't read. You can't show me the Romans Road to Salvation because I can't read it. And she says, hey, take this book. Let's talk about it. Okay. She died last December, 2016. So that's when her story came to my attention. sometimes we think we need to travel halfway around the world, 6,000, 10,000 miles away, to be a missionary. However, what really matters and what she realized was, what's really important is whether the people we meet matter to us as much as they matter to God. Right? Every single person you meet, do they matter to you as much as they matter to God? Later in life, when she was older and had been living in the UK for a while, she said, one of the major problems I had was in learning to live a consistent Christian life wherever God put me. I spent 20 years in Congo and in Central Africa, where in many ways it was very easy to be a Christian. I was the only pale skin among some 80,000 dark-skinned people. Wherever I went, I was immediately known as the missionary. When Africans met me, they would say, "If you're a missionary, your job is talking about Jesus, so get on with it and talk about Jesus." It was relatively easy. Then the Lord called me back to live and work in the UK. I loved being a missionary in the middle of Africa. I found it much harder to love affluent Westerners. This is what she says. "But I've learned that it doesn't matter to God where he puts us. We have to learn to be consistent Christians and 100% in love with Jesus and fully committed to our deepest desire to be pleasing to him at all times, no matter where he places us." That's a great way to think about missions wherever you are. That it's a reflection of who you are, right? You have to be a consistent Christian and 100% in love with Jesus. I don't care whether you're in your classroom or your workplace or your home or at the store, to be 100% committed to Jesus and committed to loving him. And then in some way, God can, may, maybe eventually use that to open doors. And she realized that, no matter where God places you. People wonder why God allowed Helen Roosevelt to endure such hardship and horror. Like, why doesn't God protect missionaries? This sometimes gets me frustrated. It gets me angry. These people are going in these places where I wouldn't go. I wouldn't want to go. I wouldn't want to send my children. And yet they're going, and they're horribly treated. They're attacked. They're killed. Why doesn't God protect us wherever we are, when we're trying to do a good work for the gospel? And the only answer she heard from God is this, that God was speaking and God says to us, "Can you thank me for trusting you with this experience, even if I never tell you why? Can you thank me for trusting you with this experience, even if I never tell you why?" We can ask why till we're blue in the face. But sometimes God just doesn't give us an answer. He sometimes, and mostly, says, "Trust me." God doesn't always give us the answer to all your questions. Why things are so difficult. Why you can't get past a certain point. Why the world seems to be caving in on you. He simply says, "Trust me." So do you know what Christians in Southern Springs, Texas are doing today? They're going to church. Do you know what Christians all across the world are doing today? They're going to church. Why? Because as Christians, we believe and we know that we follow a God who has suffered and died, yet he lives. You know, Christians do not find safety from the threat of violence just because we're part of a church. Christians know that in the midst of violence, death is not the end point. Death has no power over us. Christians around the world are persecuted and executed for their faith. Yet we do not label them as victims, because in them we see the power that Jesus promised us, that his power is made perfect in our weakness. Christians believe that we are already dead, but we have life because of Jesus Christ. Helen Roosevelt believed that. Jim Elliot and the other four men believe that. John and Betty Stamm, who we'll be introduced to next week, believe that. And I hope you believe it too. That our lives have already been paid for. In a sense, we're already dead. But Jesus and the power of the Holy Spirit breathes life into us. And because of that, wherever we go, we can be followers of Jesus and speak of the gospel. Let's pray. So let me ask you a question. Are you always asking God, why? are you incessantly complaining about your situation? Why isn't it better? Why can't this situation change? Why can't I get out of this point in time? But can you hear God saying to you, can you thank me for trusting you with this experience, even if I never tell you why? Trust me. Father, I pray for your Spirit upon every person in this room, that they would trust you. Yeah, they don't have all the answers. Maybe you don't tell them all the answers. But what you tell them is to trust you in every situation, in every circumstance, in the highs and the lows of life, as we walk across the mountaintops or through the valleys, through the sunshine or through the shadows. You call us to trust you. So I pray that we would know that your power is made perfect in weakness when we allow ourselves to be weak before you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Would you please stand with us?